All right. So, we are still talking about suffering. So, last week, we said we're going to try and build kind of this this framework that we can work from. All right. So, in some ways, as soon as you, like, I come up here and I begin to talk about suffering, the varied number of ways that has come into different people's lives that are sitting here is so unique that in some ways it just feels trite to even try and describe it and give you a way to think. Because especially if it's nagging and ongoing or it just continues, then just talking about suffering in the abstract feels like you're going to the Bible, but you're not helping me actually see what's happening in my suffering and what I need to do to hang on. So hang with us for a few weeks, because the goal is just to keep pumping your system with Bible to the point that if the Bible says, like we talked about last week, from Genesis 3 to Revelation 20, it's all kind of fit in a storyline of sufferers and of people suffering, then it's going to have a lot to say to pick you up whatever kind of suffering is particularly coming your way. Whether it's suffering from the outside of life circumstances, things that have happened, you know, an earthquake in Haiti, and all of a sudden you're living with that kind of dynamics going on, or whether it's the other kind of hurts that simply come with interpersonal relationships and people dealing with one another, or whether it comes through, you know, grieving the loss of someone, all of those kinds of suffering, the Bible paints the kind of picture to handle all of those. But you have to have some kind of framework of how does the Bible put this forward so that you don't have trite answers either for yourself or for someone else. Right? Nothing's worse than you actually feeling grief and suffering and you come along and you say, yeah, I understand totally what you're going through, when you haven't had the same kind of circumstance. But that happens pretty often. So we need a richer kind of picture of saying there are times where that might be appropriate to help, and there's other times where the best thing you could do is be like Job's three friends and just sit quiet the first week. And in fact, you know what? Job would have probably been more blessed if that had just continued on, at least from, you know, most of the reading of the book of Job. So last week we kind of did this Bible storyline. So here's the storyline. So the Bible storyline, we're just pointing out that suffering encompasses almost all of the Bible story. I mean, it's just such a central theme. Genesis 3, death enters in, and until you get to Revelation, the end of the book of Revelation, where it's finally wiped out, it just covers everything. All right, and so today, just trying to get a few of what are the purposes that God actually has with our suffering. Okay, we're just building this box so that wherever you end up locating yourself in that box for suffering that comes to you, people you're helping throughout, you're just working in this framework. Okay, what does the Bible tell me I should do to help, to give a word of encouragement? So the first place I want to actually turn is in thinking about God's purposes is the book of Job. So flip with me to Job chapter 1. Okay, and so what Job teaches us about suffering is just different. It just brings a whole different, like the diamond gets turned and you see a whole other side of things compared to what else you've read to this point in the Bible. Right? So as you've read this point, if you're just reading through the Bible in its order, you should have the general idea that the consequences of Israel from their sin. So when Israel sins, you can see the consequences pretty clearly that come down on them. There's all of this grace that's given over and over and over again. But even as that law is given in Sinai, then you watch the rest of the history of the people of Israel. There's sin and consequences. Sin and consequences. You know, they go after the Baal of Peor, and they're tricked into going and sleeping with all the Moabites. Then all of a sudden you have the serpents that come and start biting people until Moses puts up the bronze serpent. It's that kind of story. And as you're going through, you start to make the one-to-one correlation that that happened to them because they sinned. And God says that explicitly at times. That happened to them because they sinned. And on top of that, I do not know anyone who's not hardwired themselves that when something happens to them, they expect some kind of fair dealing back to the person that gave it, that happened. I don't think I've ever met anyone who has read or just thought in any sense about a vicious crime that someone has done and then just blown away like, yeah, but it doesn't matter what happens to the person who did that. We're pretty well hardwired with, if this is what you did, there is a consequence that should go with it. Our consciences are wired that way. But now we've got to wrestle with the book of Job. So Job chapter 1, because it sheds a whole different kind of light on things. So first, the book of Job, these first 8 verses, just describe a man who is God's ideal in a lot of ways. He is righteous. God has also blessed him with incredible wealth. Every time his sons and daughters even have parties, he's out there making intercessory prayer on their behalf. He is devoted to righteousness. And then we read, let's start in verse 6. Now there was a day the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came among them. So Satan is the word for accuser. So it's this picture of this one who's going to make a case against Job. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered Yahweh, "From going to and fro on the earth, walking up and down on it." Yahweh says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Right? This is why it's a truly righteous man. Then Satan answered Yahweh, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand, touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And Yahweh said to Satan, "Behold, all that is in your hand, only against him do not stretch out your hand." So then the whole scene unfolds. If you haven't read Job, these servants start rushing in, and they're just declaring every emergency that could happen in a person's life. Everything is just suddenly coming against Job. The whole wave of everything that can be bad for him is happening. And then, of course, Job doesn't give up his faith. So Satan comes back again, and he says, "Yeah, anyone can endure all of that. But you strike him, you let me go after him individually, he'll crumble." God allows it. Job is cursed with some kind of sore that's just almost unbearable. And here's how chapter 1 ends. Verse 20, "Then Job arose, he tore his robe, he shaved his head, he fell on the ground and he worshipped, and he said, 'Naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. Yahweh gave, and Yahweh's taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh.'" Now here's the commentary that the Lord gives us. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Okay, and at the end of the book, in chapter 42, God vindicates everything that Job said. So even in all of Job's wrestling with God that's going to come about, even in all of his struggles to try to, you know, articulate why he feels like everything he sees, he's suffering unjustly, unfairly, all of that wrestling with God, he is still somehow completely entrusting himself to God. Okay? Now, just four observations, because if you don't have a category for what happens in the book of Job, we can treat suffering like it's 1 + 1 equals consequences. You know, you plus, you know, the circumstances you see in your life equals, your personal circumstances, and then you add in, you know, what other people are telling you, and you draw the conclusion, I must have sinned. But Job helps you say, okay, there's more going on in what God is doing than just that. All right, so you can see on your sheet there, four just observations from Job. One, suffering is a very, very real thing. That is counter to huge numbers of people on this planet. Huge numbers of people, because of suffering, have looked for other answers for how to say the things that are happening have to be, I mean, the old Buddhist way of thinking of it was it's an illusion of some kind. And if your mind is in the right kind of state, you can work through these things and sometimes even change, depending on what you think, change your circumstances. So it's not real in the way that the Christian thinks of it as real. For us, suffering is real, and it requires faith then to trust that whatever God's doing in it matters. Okay, two, God's sovereign over suffering. Right? So the Christian comes back to a verse like Ephesians 1:11 that he works everything according to the counsel of his will. And however you're going to fit that in, it's the baseline. It's the baseline that everything else is built on. If you can't have some sort of confidence that the things you can't see is not all there is to the picture, then you're going to have trouble getting faith in any regard at all. So when I was talking about that Hebrews 13 passage in the sermon a couple weeks ago, it's just that idea that you're in a pasture. As soon as you recognize your creatureliness, you're in a pasture. All you can see is, you know, kind of the edge of the grass out here, or as most sheep are, just head down eating all the time. You're not aware until the wolf is upon you that anything else is strange. But the shepherd is standing on the rock, staff in hand, eyes all over the place. He's listening for howls that are so far away that you haven't even recognized. He's just administrating so many things that are just outside of your normal daily reach. So it's just a baseline that Christians have to work with, that God is sovereign. And of course, Job confesses the same thing right there. Shall we receive? This is in chapter 2, in 10, when his wife comes to him and says, it's time for you to abandon this track of God. Job says, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God and not evil? In all this, again, the reminder, Job didn't sin with his lips. Job's not looking for his suffering. He's not trying to make some easy excuse of like, well, of course, good comes, bad comes. But he's giving you a principle there of, this is the God, and so anything that comes from his hand, I'm ready and willing to embrace because he's in control of it all. Okay, third thing there. There is such a thing as innocent suffering. And that's one of the things that you have to take away. Now, I mean, innocent, not in the fact that Job doesn't live in a fallen world. If Satan is going around ready to accuse, ready to wreak havoc, then sin has entered the world. Job is just as much of a son of Adam as the rest of us are. And we'll get in further weeks. We'll talk more about original sin and how that plays into kind of this whole story of, because we're in Adam, we participate in this suffering world. But Job's case, the point that whoever's writing Job is making is, Job didn't do anything that can be tied to the suffering that he endured. All of his friends for the next 30 plus chapters are going to be piling up different reasons of which he must have sinned, and he must have said something, and he must have had this in his heart, and he must have done this. And Job's argument over and over again is, I haven't done any of those things. I've done what God asked. I've been righteous. I know who my Redeemer is. And I'll be vindicated by all these things. So there is a kind of innocent suffering of which things that we can say don't deserve to happen to people do happen to them. And it's not tied to any sin specifically of theirs. And that should alter your perspective of how you enter into somebody else's suffering. And it just makes you slower. If you think you see what you think you see may not be all that you see. And especially just for those of you that are younger, it just, you feel like you can see so much. And you just can't. In 30 years, you'll look back and go, oh, I didn't even know those are all the other things that were happening. You'll hear stories about other people in your life and what all was going on at that time. And you'll be like, oh, I wish I had given them way more grace for what was happening. And then you'll get 30 years more down the road and be like, whoa, I didn't even see all of those things that were happening. So it just causes us to be patient. We learned that from Job. There is such a thing as innocent suffering. And then this last point, what it causes us to do is then, just like the rest of the Bible unfolds, it causes us to actually trust God, to lean on Him. So what's so fascinating about Job, flip over with me to chapter 38. So if you haven't ever actually read through Job, none of the suffering itself gets resolved. Job has question after question after question, and when God comes to him, there's no answer in the way that we would like an answer. So he's ready to bring his complaint before God. In chapter 38, then Yahweh answered Job. Okay, what's he going to tell him about all this suffering? He answered him out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man, and I will question you, and you make it known to me. See, what's shocking about that, maybe if you've read it a lot, it may not feel as shocking as that is, but you've seen Job's agony, you've walked with him through his agony, and like, you know, you're reading it for the first time, you're like, these guys just keep questioning him, and they're going to break through at some point. He's going to finally admit sin. But he's vindicated. God says he hasn't committed any sin. And then God's choice to answer him is, now I'm going to ask you questions. And the next three full chapters are nothing but God asking questions like this. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, that's verse 4, 38:12. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? 38, this is from 22 and 23. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? Verses 31, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Can you guide the bear with his children? You remember Planet Earth? There's a scene in Planet Earth where the bear pops its head out, kind of beginning of spring. It's been living under the snow in one of these mountain ranges. And it pops up and begins to walk. And it's got this short amount of time with these cubs following it that it's got to catch whatever, seal, walrus, some fish, you know, coming from them. And it's like, there, you have no answer for how every year from that hibernation to that bear succeeding and living and those cubs living, how God is handling and directing those kinds of things. So Job's response is just this, is this questioning. And this is, he ends in chapter 40 in verse 8. So, in verse 7, the Lord repeats this line, "Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" So you think Jesus stepping on the scene, right? Every person who comes before Jesus and he begins to question them immediately is trying to figure out, how do I justify myself before this man? How can I say I've done more good than he's really expecting? How can I somehow justify myself? And all of those people end up, they can't stand being around Jesus because there is no way that you can justify yourself. And instead, all the people that come to Jesus and be like, "I've got no justification for what I did. I just take your forgiveness open-handed. I repent. Everything you said about me was absolutely true without remark. And there's probably more. Can I have your grace?" And all of a sudden it's pouring out freely. So, right, it's this picture that now Job is painting is that God has purposes that are just far greater and he doesn't have to answer us. There's no line that says God has to answer us for any of the things that are happening. But you can absolutely just bank on him. This is one of the lines from Job 39. And just listen, even in all of this questioning that the Lord is giving to Job, he's reminding Job of how much care he gives to all the other creatures of the world. He says, "Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch and bring forth their offspring and are delivered of their young?" Right. So even in all of this question, he's not just saying, "You lack understanding, you lack understanding, you lack understanding." He spells it out in such detail that Job can see all of the other care God gives to all of the other creatures. That's not going to bypass me. It's not going to go around me. He's caring for me as well. Right. You can picture Jesus just out on the hillside, grabbing this humongous crowd of people around him and just reminding them, "Have you seen the flowers? Flowers are dressed quite nicely. They do just fine. Your heavenly Father takes care of them. Have you seen the birds? Right? They're doing great. They're not lacking for food at all. The Lord takes care of them." Right? The Lord is bringing that kind of picture even in this awakening Job. And of course, Job has the right reaction at the end. Gets down in the dust, puts his hand over his mouth, and just says, I don't understand. Woe is me. I don't have a clue of what all the Lord is doing. And that's the proper response for Job after his questioning. It's probably the proper response for almost all of us when we begin to rail and rage. All right. So the book of Job, what it adds is just a different picture of God is doing far more than what we expect, and it's a call to then to trust him. Okay. Any questions, thoughts, anything else there on the book of Job? Okay. So now let's talk about some of the purposes that we do have actually revealed to us. There, number two, flip with me to Philippians chapter 1. One of the things that's been revealed to us that our sufferings, like our faith, are actually a gift we need to kind of have the right attitude of embracing and taking in and saying, okay, this all ties together as part of my salvation. Okay, so Philippians 1. Remember, Paul is, he's writing this letter from prison himself. He's aware of the chains on his feet when he writes this. He's not abstract in any sort of way. And he says, there, you know, let's begin in verse 27. He's going to exhort them, let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you, and that you are standing firm in one spirit, and with one mind striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it's been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake. So do you hear that? Like, you're engaged in this suffering well, this letting your life be a reflection of the gospel, and it's actually teaching your opponents that God is real and will judge them, and it's actually encouraging saints over here. And let me just remind you, the reason is because God's granted it, he's gifted it to you, to not only believe in this gospel and have all of these promises, securities, hope, these kinds of things, but he's also granted this and gifted this suffering for your sake, because it's doing those same kinds of things. The way you suffer is teaching outsiders that the judgment of God is really going to come, whether that's through your suffering well and your hope is remaining in God, and they begin to see it and say, okay, they really believe there's something after this life of which all of this is going to be made right. Whether it's that or whether it's other things that they're understanding. And then, it encourages the other believers, just like it did earlier in chapter 1 of Philippians, where other people are actually proclaiming the gospel and guards and others are beginning to believe because Paul's in prison. So first, you know, God's purpose, it's beginning to flow out. The suffering is given you as a gift, and it begins to move outward toward people. All right, other revealed purposes. First, so let's just kind of run through some of these. Yeah, let's use our last 7 minutes just to run through some of these. If on any of them you have other verses that come to mind on some of these things, you know, just raise your hand and you know, there might be other good ones to write down and just scribble on and think through. So first, God's revealed purpose in suffering, one, to grow us in holiness. Okay, I don't know if you've ever read through Psalm 119 and thought about it as a sufferer. A lot of Psalm 119 is someone in agony. So all of those lines about, you know, your word is a lamp unto my feet, your, you know, how does a young man keep his way pure by guarding it according to your, all those lines about how great the scriptures are all written by someone in agony. So Psalm 119:67 says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. So there's that line. I don't know if you've read C.S. Lewis's Problem of Pain, but he says, God kind of he whispers in our pleasures. He speaks to our consciences and he shouts in our pain. And it's just kind of a good summary of saying, it's like a megaphone up in your face when you're suffering. Just calling you to all of the promises becoming real for you and more tangible and more hopeful. It increases the, how should I walk now in light of that? How am I going to respond to these kinds of things? And of course, there's plenty in the Bible that even, you know, you think of 1 Peter 3 and the wife, who seems to have the same kind of issues in other First Peter of a husband who's an unbeliever, her conduct might just win him. Her holiness, her the way she acts, the way she carries herself, might just win her husband over. And First Peter is bringing out that theme over and over again. Our holiness, it's a shining light to the rest of the world, especially in our suffering. Okay, secondly, one of God's purposes that he reveals to us is to build perseverance or endurance. Okay, so let's think back just to 1 Thessalonians 1. We talked about faith, hope, and love a couple of weeks ago. Right? It was their labor of love, but it was their steadfast hope. It was their endurance that was just being. I mean, we're gonna get, as we keep going through Thessalonians, the next section is going to talk about how all the Macedonians know about your behavior. Because through all of their agony, they are enduring and enduring and enduring and enduring in such a way that it's characterized by faith, hope, and love. Okay, so Hebrews 12:1. This is, you know, one verse that helps about this. We're responsible to continue. Our race of witnesses. I have the wrong one written down here. Here we go. Hebrews 12:1. Since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely. What does that sound like? Like similar to growing in holiness as well, right? So let go of the sin which clings so closely. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus. All right, Colossians 1, we're to continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel. You know, Romans 5, therefore, since we've been justified by faith, we have peace with God. But he immediately goes on in that section in verse 3 to say, and we rejoice in our sufferings. Why? Because we know our sufferings produce, and one of the first things there is endurance. If you value endurance, if you value, you know, being able to make it, not being flighty, not thinking Christianity is just kind of 3 years of your best life and then on to the next thing. If you value getting to the end, finishing well, those kinds of things. If you can see God's purpose is to actually, through your suffering, get you to that, then you have way more hope. All right. Third, maturity. And of course, this is huge theme in James, right? Don't be vacillating in your attention to God. Be full of integrity. That is, you've devoted yourself to God. So count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet various kinds of trials, for you know the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and when steadfastness, endurance, has its full effect, you're perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. The suffering helps get you to the end. It builds maturity in the meantime. And maturity, fruitfulness, is what we want out of all of us. That's part of what we're doing together when we join together as a church. We want edified, and then that allows people to be fruitful. Fruitful people are maturing people. The fruit from the fruit tree is not good the first few years, or it's sparse. But by the time you get 15 years into a good apple tree that's been cared for, guess what you see? It's nearly breaking the limbs because there's so much goodness hanging from the tree. And that's what we want to get to. All right, fourth, God actually uses suffering. One of his purposes is to teach us the word. You know, all of one of you, myself included, we sit in a chair, you're listening to a sermon, and I mean, especially when you got little ones crawling on your lap, or you're thinking about something else, and the word is just kind of bouncing off, right? Just kind of bouncing off. But you're in the midst of something difficult, and you're actually hungry to hear something from God. You're actually hungry to get fed. And all of a sudden, any word that's spoken, I'm sure Tony's had the same feelings I have. I've had people come up and say, that illustration, like, was nothing as far as one of the points of the sermon. Oh, I see the logic of the passage much better. Nothing like that, but that one illustration or whatever helped unlock this. I don't think that was the point that I was even trying to get, but I'm glad God used that to get to that point for you. So he teaches us his word just as we're walking this life, and suffering is one of those things. It just opens the eyes. It digs out the ears. It makes you receptive and ready and hungry for the word of God. Psalm 119:71, it's good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Who knows how long the psalmist was sitting there going over and over again, not being able to actually hear it. And then under the affliction, it was like God speaks clearly. All right. Let's stop there. You can see the kind of the back half of them there, being able to encourage. You know, we could talk all morning about how suffering is one of the few things that can root out an entitled kind of attitude in us. We don't like when it happens and we feel entitled to more. And most of us are kind of carry on our lives a lot of times feeling entitled in all sorts of different ways. Suffering and seeing that God is using it is one of the ways of which you just say, this is what's come my way. Help me, Lord, to walk through it as faithful as I can. I don't actually deserve better. And all of a sudden, the whole paradigm of the kingdom and what it's like to enter the kingdom is just so valuable to you. It's so valuable because that's how we enter. All right. Any questions or thoughts on, or even on any of those last four? All right. Well, let's get ready for worship then.